now moving to the major speaking section of our program. We are very pleased to have Dr. Kenneth R. Williams to participate in Challenge 65 by introducing the first of our major speakers tonight. In 1951, Dr. Williams received the Freedom Foundation Award, the Negro Man of the Year Award, and the National Chamber of Commerce Award. In 1963, he was sent to Poland by the American Association of Colleges for teaching education. In 1936, Dr. Williams joined the faculty of Winston-Salem State Teachers College as chaplain and instructor of history. He was appointed Dean of Men in 1946, and in 1962, Dr. Williams was named to his current position as president of Winston-Salem State Teachers College. Dr. Williams.
We are fortunate tonight in having as our speaker a distinguished young man who comes from a family that has distinguished itself in the area of interest responsible for our being here. The ideas expressed by the founder of the Democrat Times of Greenville, Mississippi in 1936 were not popular opinions to be expressed in Mississippi at that time. They are not too popular in some places in Mississippi and outside of Mississippi, even to this day. The elder Carter continued to express himself. His paper grew and began to attract national attention. Our speaker has carried on the tradition of his father since he became the managing editor of the paper in 1960. He is an honor graduate of Princeton University and has done additional study in the Woodrow Wilson School of that university. His book, The South Strikes Back, was published in 1959. Currently, he is writing two books, and these should be ready for publication during 1966. The editorials of the Democrat Times, as written by our speaker and his father, have a lasting value for America. Doubleday Publishing Company is working on a collection of these editorials. This, we're all happy to say, will assure their preservation. It is a great pleasure and an honor for me to have the opportunity to present one of America's most promising young men, Mr. Hardin Carter III of Greenville, Mississippi, the editor of the Democrat Times. Mr. Carter.
Dr. Williams, members of the staff of Challenge 65, ladies and gentlemen. I thought when I got on the plane to come up here that I was leaving certain things behind me, and at least one well-known or at least well-publicized trait of Mississippi behind me, and that is to say our well-known homicide rate. For casual reading on the plane, I picked up an article discussing violence in the United States and discovered that Winston-Salem ranked second in the nation in homicides. I feel at home. I also feel, as a matter of fact, in coming here to talk about this particular subject, a little bit like the monkey who found himself alone after all the bombs had fallen and the last bit of nuclear holocaust had been inflicted. He found himself alone in one devastated city, and he was walking alone down a deserted street saying over and over again, "I'm so hungry. I'm so hungry." And no word came back to that little monkey. And he wandered some more, saying, "I'm so hungry." And then, from behind one rubble-strewn wall, there came a soft feminine voice. "Have an apple. Have an apple." "What?" said the monkey, "and start that damn mess all over again?" But I am here tonight to start it over, to discuss with you, as many far more qualified than I will talk to you, on this general topic. It is, of course, grossly misleading for me, a white Mississippian, to speak to you of the Negro in Mississippi and to pose in any way as an expert in doing it. I would rather then abandon what is, I think, a title of convenience and speak of something that I have known by necessity for most of my life and which I intend to know for the rest of my life. I could, of course, give you some of the qualifications I might possess as an expert in this field. I have more than 2 weeks of quick journeying through the state. I have, I suppose, the usual scars that make good stories. And yet, when measured against what has happened to the Negro in Mississippi, to sit here and pose as some kind of martyr, or to stand here and say, "This has happened to me," would be presumptuous, it would be pompous, and it would be totally misleading. It has, of course, had its drawbacks. To edit a paper today, and for my father for over 25 years, in a state with whose institutions we were at basic odds. But whenever I think about the usual image of the crusading editor, I always bring myself down to earth with a memory of one particular night in Mississippi, November 1st, 1962, to be exact. The night before, September 30th, 1962, the insurrection at the University of Mississippi had reared its ugly head. My father, my mother, my brother, my uncles were all in New Orleans, where he was and is writer in residence at Tulane. We had had the usual phone calls, and as the fighting picked up considerably at the university, my parents called about 11:30 and wanted to know how things were going in Greenville. I talked first to my father and said everything was fine. I then talked to my mother and said that we did have police around the newspaper and we had had the bombing threats and this sort of thing. And unfortunately, my father, whose temper is famous, at least in our part of the world, heard this particular part of the conversation. He immediately said, "Barricade the doors, grab the guns, I'm coming up." He proceeded to get my mother to drive him, ran by my brother's apartment, my brother having been married for 1 week, my sister-in-law describing it something like the Gestapo's knock at the door, dragged my brother out of the house, got my uncle, and they proceeded to drive the 330 miles to Greenville. In the meantime, I had a couple of friends out at the house and a deputy sheriff, and we stayed up all that night with guns around the house waiting for something to happen. And of course, the blood was being spilled and lives were being lost at Ole Miss, and nothing at all happened to us in Greenville. And that morning about 6:30, Dad, my mother, my brother, my uncle, with guns out of every window, came driving up the alleyway. And they poured out, "And is everything all right?" "Yes, everything's all right." And so we went to work that day and put out the paper, and we came home that night exhausted, and we all went to bed at 9 o'clock, and at 10 o'clock they burned the cross. we were asleep. And never knew it was burned. And so much for our heroism in Mississippi. I want to make this talk on several premises. I'm talking as a reporter. I'm talking also as an editor. I'm talking, obviously, as a white Mississippian. I want to make this plain also. In November 1964, I would have given a far different speech. I pose as no prophet. 3 months from now, I might give a different one also. And yet, you can only speak from where you are and where you think you're going and where you know you've been. And that is what I'm going to say tonight. The backdrop for these remarks is a state which is, for its own history, in unexpectedly rapid flux. This is a state which an excellent book by a knowledgeable man could label the closed society. And in that book, Jim Silver could predict that there was no break foreseeable in the near future. He was right from that perspective, the perspective of the horror of the Ole Miss rioting, of what had happened to him, and to what had happened in Mississippi for 10 years. My speech in November would have been called the closed society. And yet consider what has happened in Mississippi just since September 1964, and more especially in this year, 1965. The state which said never now has token integration in three of its public school systems. It has from 18 public school systems announcements that they will, without court order, go into some form of integration. We have from the leading business organization in Mississippi, the Mississippi Economic Council, which is a state chamber of commerce, what is for Mississippi an incredibly far-ranging declaration that the federal law, the federal writ, runs in Mississippi as in the rest of the United States. We have this from a group of men who, 2 short years before, found it impossible to come out with a statement simply for law and order without throwing in the disclaimer, but of course we know that the Supreme Court is wrong. No disclaimer in the Mississippi Economic Council statement. We must comply with the law. We must be in the mainstream of America. We must move forward by accommodating ourselves. This is Mississippi, and this is incredible. We have finally, belatedly, late, springing up around the state, human relations councils, biracial councils, if you will, in 3 or 4 or 5 communities, where before the mere notion that white and Negro would talk together except as employer and employee, as object and mover, was unheard of, treasonable, dangerous. We have in my hometown, for the first time since Reconstruction, the appointment of a Negro to a major city commission, and there will be many more. Why? Why even these small but oh so significant changes in Mississippi? Well, you can start with the obvious. You can say that the passage of the Civil Rights Act and the final impact of this act upon Mississippi had its effect. And it has, it does, and it will even more so in the next few months. I think, however, that you have to look beyond the act itself. You have to look to what I believe was perhaps the most important single national development insofar as the white and Negro Mississippi consciousness in Mississippi was concerned, and that was the election returns of November 1964. Because for Mississippi, that election was a great national referendum. It was a referendum on the Civil Rights Act of 1964. It was a referendum on the Supreme Court decision of 1954. It was a referendum on street demonstrations. It was a referendum, in fact, on whether there was going to be any one last chance for the white established pattern of segregation. Mississippi voted 87% for Barry Goldwater. The nation voted 61% for Lyndon Johnson. And when Mississippi, white Mississippi, woke up to what that meant, then I think, and only then, the full impact of the Civil Rights Act, beyond the law itself, began to seep in. For the Negro in Mississippi, the election in which he worked outside the political process, because he is disenfranchised for the large part outside the political process, represented the victory of a candidate for whom he had worked in the Freedom Democratic Party in this extra legal but also meaningful political party. Even while the establishment's candidate in Mississippi was going down a crushing defeat. A third factor, as far as a change in Mississippi is concerned, is the pure force of economics. Industrialists are not what I would call notably social reformers. They are, however, very interested in social stability. And the murders of Philadelphia, Mississippi, of Eastern Mississippi, the obvious unrest, the rise of certain groups, all of these have contributed to what finally our politicians are admitting has been a slackening, dwindling, dying economic growth. Certainly our statistics look good because they are built on such a small base. But those who know, those who have to look at it closely, knew we weren't attracting industry. Other industries were going other places. And this became meaningful, if not for the man in the small rural Mississippi, then to the man in Jackson and Greenville and even Macomb, Gulfport, and the new towns. There was a side effect also that these various boycotts of Mississippi products, which are for the most part political gestures announced and not carried very far, were nevertheless being felt, just in small ways. But they're being felt in such a way that the individual manufacturer who gets a kickback from a man in Long Island and says, look, somebody just brought back all these appliances because she found out they were made in Mississippi, this gets through. We have finally the work of the Council of Federated Organizations, COFO, of the National Council of Churches through the Delta Ministry. The work, which in statistical terms cannot be measured with any precision, which in accomplishments, which you can rack up and say so many of this, so many of that, was almost negligible, but which within the Negro community was a final severing of the notion that no one outside of Mississippi cared, of the notion that the Negro in Mississippi had no allies, no hope for community cohesiveness, no hope for presenting a united face in pressing for change. This was changed, this was ended by COFO, by the National Council. And while I can say in all honesty that I have disagreed with some tactics, I can also say in all honesty that there's plenty of room in Mississippi for every element which adds ferment to the situation that can possibly come in, for it is only through that that these changes can take place. And as all this has been going on, the good whites who have been there all along, the decent, responsible whites, the silent whites, the scared whites, have been coming out of hiding. And even some of the politicians who perhaps are not sure that the odds are with them now, but aren't sure at all that they won't be by 1967 in the next general election in Mississippi, have begun to talk a little bit more like middle-of-the-road types and a little less like 1920 stereotypes of the racist. So much then for the happy picture, the changing picture. We are something less than a tranquil state. We are something less than all the way to the millennium. We had just a week ago in a neighboring town the burning of a freedom school to the ground. We have community after community in Mississippi in which the impact of the Civil Rights Act has not yet been felt, despite general compliance with the public accommodation section. We still have had no convictions in any race murder, white against Negro, in the state. The killers of the three at Philadelphia, of Medgar Evers, have a long string of names going back as far as I can remember, are still walking free. We still have, in a state in which the population is only 42%, which is 42% Negro, voting by less than 5% of the adult Negro population. We have in Mississippi, for the first time since the 20s, and perhaps for the first time in any meaningful sense since Reconstruction, the rising of a Ku Klux Klan, and the Klan is small in numbers, true enough. But its secrecy, its violence, its logical, final extension of many of white supremacy's myths make it dangerous and make it something we're going to be reckoning with for some time yet. We have other organizations that go under other names that do the same thing, and we still have with us the Citizens Council, which was the responsible racist organization. The ones who are going to defend our way of life not with violence but with economic pressure and intimidation. Who held full political control of the state under Ross Barnett and thought they had it under Paul Johnson, and found that Governor Johnson could read election returns better than Governor Barnett. These are still with us. And so when you look to the future of Mississippi, when you look to the future of, as a matter of fact, when I think about topics, I think you can just say the future of Mississippi, which means the future of the Negro, which means the future of the white, which means the future of us all bound in together because we are inextricably. When you look to the future of Mississippi, you can say a few things. Some areas are going to still catch hell, and they're going to catch it bad. We're going to have our Selmas still, simply because there are areas which are determined that there will be no change, federal law, federal courts, federal mandate, Negro desire, or even despite change in neighboring communities. And there are many reasons for this. Sociologists could tell you better than I. We're going to have violence. It's going to be a different kind of violence in Mississippi, though. It has been over the last year, and it's going to be more along this line. It's going to be the violence that comes about because of the friction of those who are rising with those who are on top, rather than the violence which comes from the man on top unilaterally kicking the man on the bottom. It'll be a little different from the last 100 years. I'm not suggesting now there's going to be a lot of Negro violence aimed at whites. I simply mean that the violence is going to be symptomatic of the change. It's going to be regrettable. I hate to see it where it is. but it represents the change that is with us. For myself, for my own community, I think we're beyond that. I'm certain, as a matter of fact, that we're over that particular hump, but there are many who won't be. I think what is going to be refreshing about Mississippi, and if I have nothing else to say tonight, it's this, that for the first time in my lifetime, in my father's lifetime, what you're going to see increasingly in Mississippi is diversity. No longer the monolithic front in the white community, no longer the silent Negro minority, but diversity across the board, individual decisions rather than group dictates. And this, for me, is the happiest and the best event, the best prediction that I can see. The snake's back is broken in Mississippi. But like most broken back snakes, it can still bite and it's still poisonous. And it's going to cause that trouble. And underlying all of this, and in this I would almost want to echo Governor Paul Johnson when he said, all right, we're trying, will you please get off our backs and try to come along to help us. Underlying all of this is Mississippi's incredible cycle of poverty, bad education, no jobs, poverty, bad education, which afflicts not merely the Negro, but also the white. And without a solution to this, the other solutions, the achievement of legality, of legalisms, that is, of the change, of legal change, is going to be meaningless not merely to the Negro, but to too many whites. We are going to have that undergirding, supporting many of the bad elements in Mississippi until we can come down to grips, and in this we're going to need a lot of help from outside of the state, economic help, educational help, federal help. But here we are, no longer Jim Silver's totally closed society, but a society that's coming apart at the seams, a society which is beginning to have leadership, which is groping to bring us back into the United States of 1965. You once could speak of the solid South, and as someone said, that South is dead. You once could speak of the closed society, and I can say today, thank God, that society is also dead. Thank you.
Auden Carter III speaking to a crowd in Whitechapel on the campus of Wake Forest College in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. The crowd right now will leave for about 15 minutes to take time out and rest while the next speaker gets ready to deliver his address. And the next speaker will be Ned Kenworthy, E.W. Kenworthy, congressional correspondent for the New York Times. Whitechapel now holds approximately 2,200 people, and it must be at least half full. The delegates to the Wake Forest Symposium on Contemporary World Affairs are filing out now, as well as the Winston-Salem residents and the Wake Forest students that are here for the symposium. And during this time, we'll take 10 seconds out to pause for station identification. This is Challenge 65 on the Wake Forest Radio Network.
WFDD-FM, Winston-Salem.
This is Bill Stresner once again, back in Whitechapel on the campus of Wake Forest College in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Previous to Hutton Carter's major address in this challenge symposium, Mr. Carter, the first of three major lecturers, The second, as we told you, will be Ned Kenworthy, and the third will be James Farmer, National Director of CORE, and he will speak at a banquet at 7:15, and most of these same stations will bring you that lecture also and bring it to you live. That's 7:15 tomorrow night for James Farmer, National Director of CORE. Earlier tonight, the symposium was kicked off by a panel with Dr. Thomas Pettigrew, Associate Professor of Social Psychology at Harvard University and author of A Profile of a Negro America, and Mrs. Daisy Balsley, Head of the English Department at Winston-Salem State Teachers College, Mr. C.A. McKnight, Charlotte Observer Editor, and Mr. George Faust, Director of New Jersey Division on Civil Rights. They were the panelists, and the panel was moderated by the Professor of Political Science at Wake Forest, one of them, Dr. Harold Rhodes. Dr. Rhodes was previously a speechwriter for the present Governor of Arizona, Governor Sam Goddard. Dr. Rhodes also taught at the University of Arizona. Right now, we are awaiting the second major address of the evening, this by E.W. Kenworthy, civil rights reporter for the New York Times, and something about Mr. Kenworthy.